Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the political party. Firstly, Happy New Year. I hope you had a good Christmas. I hope you're having a great start to the year and that you are excited about another thrilling year in politics. Today's guest is Dan Hodges from the Mail on Sunday, but so much more as well. He's written for the New Statesman. He's written his own book. He's involved in all sorts of things and he's led a fascinating life. And we talk about that in some detail about his upbringing. His mum, Glenda Jackson, the Oscar winning actor and a former Labour MP, and the effect or otherwise that had on him politically and where his own politics are and how he sees politics. It's just a brilliant conversation about being a political columnist. What it's like to work for the Mail on Sunday, where his own politics are, his view of politics, whether he's ever been that ideological or tribal. It really is wonderful. And he's a phenomenal talker, as gifted a talker as he is a writer. And just such a great guest to start the new year with. And particularly with the way politics is going, it's fascinating that I'm sure Dan wouldn't mind me saying this. It's obvious, really, if you follow him on social media, you're familiar with who he is. Not enamoured with the previous leadership of the Labour Party. So in a really interesting position, writing for the Mail on Sunday to give his perspective on the likelihood of a Labour victory and how Labour do it and all those things. The live shows return in just a few weeks and there's only a handful of tickets left for a couple of these shows. On Monday, the 23rd of January, my guests are Emily Maitlis and John Soapel. There aren't many tickets left for that. I'll be able to announce the guests for the 6th of February soon. On the 20th of February, my guest is Keir Starmer. There aren't many tickets left for that. My guest on the 6th of March is Eddie Izzard, and tickets for that are going very, very quickly as well. And guests for the 20th of March onwards will be announced soon. Some mega guests coming up. So go to mattford.com. I've also put a link in the blurb where you can buy tickets for future shows and also a link where you can buy Dan's book, 1 Minute to 10, about the 2015, the night of the 2015 election, which is a real thriller about that night. So without further ado, here is Dan Hodges. Delighted to be joined by Dan Hodges from the Mail on Sunday. But Dan, that doesn't really fully encapsulate it, does it? You know when you say
that's only one of my many political crimes, isn't it?
Exactly.
Part of my rap sheet.
I mean, it doesn't really. I think it's really interesting that because previously, now, when I'd have been about 18, if I'd have heard a columnist's name and then the organ that they worked for, I would have made all sorts of presumptions about their politics. But I don't think that's true with you, is it? I mean, you're not a typical Daily Mail or Mail on Sunday columnist. You've had a rich and varied political background. I mean, where would you place yourself on the political spectrum now?
Well, as ever with these things, there's the sort of the cliche that, you know, we all stay where we are and politics moves around us. I mean, I still regard myself as one of those, you know, that sort of worst of all of the political tribes. I'm still pretty much a dyed-in-the-wool centrist, to be honest, which is quite a difficult gig in the modern political environment. But you know, it is what it is, and there's no point me trying to pretend I'm something I'm not. I mean, I've got to say, I mean, you know, one of the things why I, you know, really enjoy writing for the Mail on Sunday in the Mail is, you know, we do actually have quite a diverse range of opinions. And, you know, whenever I sort of speak to people about this, you know, I always say, look, you only need to go back to the referendum where, you know, the Mail on Sunday was advocating Remain and the Daily Mail was advocating Leave to give it. So, you know, I'm fortunate, you know, I'm working at a newspaper where there is a lot of space and I do have the space to basically say or write what I think, which is obviously what any commentator wants, really.
obviously the centre is quite a big place, really. I mean, in the last few years, it may have felt like it wasn't hugely represented in Parliament. But if you consider, you know, the centre, anything from Neil Kinnock to maybe even Ian Duncan Smith on the right, there's a broad spectrum of different politics within there. I mean, do you see yourself as on the left of the centre, the centre of the centre, or the right of the centre?
To be perfectly honest, I mean, again, whenever I say this, people say it's a cop out. It's just, I genuinely, it's a cliche because you can't, I genuinely can't pitch myself in any particular space. So, I mean, I don't know, the last few weeks, what have I been thinking? I've been thinking, I wrote a piece saying, I think the government should go try and push ahead with the Rwanda scheme to just try and do something to deal with this, the horrendous scene we're seeing in the English Channel, which I know a lot of people would say that puts me on the extreme right. Similarly, I was arguing at the time of Partygate, actually, I think Boris should go. That puts me on, the woke left. So, I just really, some people say, there's this great thing, everyone says, I'm politically homeless now. I wouldn't say I'm politically homeless. I'm sort of a bit of a political, global traveller, if you like. I suppose that's how I try and sort of rather inarticulately sum it up.
That's quite nice. It gives you a bit more agency over your homelessness, I guess. You're sort of choosing to move.
I can lay my hat anywhere, which is quite nice.
But did you ever go through like a teenage radical phase? Would you have ever described yourself as a socialist or a communist or a Marxist or anything like that?
God, no. I mean, when I was... that's much too deep for me. No, when I was growing up, I was politically aware in that sense because my mum was politically active and my dad was quite... He wasn't active politically, but he was quite political in a sense. But no, I mean, I was very sort of unenergized by politics. And then gradually, I just think it's a product of my environment and, product of growing up in the 80s, politics was all around you. Thatcherism was around you. The backlash against Thatcherism was all around you. So in that sense, I sort of developed a political awareness. But I was always more fascinated in the mechanics of politics, the process of politics. I was always fascinated by the media. That was what I always actually quite wanted to go into. I was always fascinated by writing. So that was kind of sort of where my sort of political consciousness, it was a broader thing rather than any sort of particular thing. I didn't have a sort of like a Matt Hancock sort of like Damascene sort of moment when the bailiffs came knocking or whatever it was that suddenly gave me a sort of great political epiphany.
You mentioned your mum there, a very special woman, Glenda Jackson, not only a Labour MP, of course, but an Oscar winner as well. Indeed. I mean, that must have been incredible growing up with her as your mum. And she was a star in two fields.
Yeah, it was fantastic. It was fantastic. I mean, again, you're supposed to say, "Oh God, I look at it from the outside and it looks great, but inside all this pressure." Also, I loved it. I mean, I just loved it. I was, my mum was sort of doing films abroad, and I was going abroad and seeing her do that and meeting all these people I saw on TV and all that sort of stuff. It was wonderful. Obviously, now one has to sort of acknowledge one's privilege, which I'm perfectly, perfectly happy to do. It was wonderful. I had an incredibly privileged upbringing and I loved every minute of it. I've got to be honest.
And she was kind of on the left, really, of the Labour Party. Was she, doesn't sound like she was too political at home, given that you didn't feel that politicised at a young age, apart from, being immersed in Thatcherism and everything that was happening at the time. So was she not one of those political parents who was talking about politics around, the
dinner table? No, I mean, it was more current affairs, and obviously politics forms about it. We weren't sitting there reading Tracts and Marx, before bedtime or anything like that. I mean, you say she's on the left. I think she ended up on the left in a sense as a product of sort of New Labourism, New Labour's journey, the Blair journey. But she was always a political pragmatist. She was always somebody, you know, she was very much rooted in a sort of working class upbringing in Birkenhead, and had a very sort of that sort of, if you like, sort of a small C sort of conservative Labour tradition, that sort of an element, the small C sort of working class socialism, if you like. And but she was always very much, you know, part of that group that thought, you know, screw the debates and screw all the abstract arguments. You know, you need a Labour government. If you want to do anything and you want to help people, you need a Labour government. And obviously everything that flowed from that.
You worked for her for a bit. I mean, that must have been a thrill, really. Was that based in Parliament?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was a Nepo baby before it was before it was fashionable or infamous or whatever it was. Yeah, I was the original Nepo baby. No, it was, yeah. I mean, it was great because, I mean, it's just a fantastic environment to work in Parliament. I mean, anyone who's worked there knows it's incredibly, incredibly exciting environment. And it was just a fantastic time to be there because, you know, I was lucky. I started working for my mum when she was elected in 92. And so I was there for the whole of that Parliament between 92 and 97. And so saw that, you know, saw the major government eventually, you know, falling apart, and obviously the rise of New Labour, and obviously the election victory. And it was a really fascinating and exciting time. And, you know, that's still, I mean, I'm sure we'll come on to it in a second, that, you know, that sort of excitement and energy. I mean, it's you know, fair play to Keir Starmer, what he's done. But I think that's the one thing that I would say, harking back, that just seems to be slightly missing from the Starmer project at the moment. But yeah, no, it was a wonderful time.
And that period then, are you saying to him, well, I quite like this Blair guy, he seems amazing. And obviously, being the pragmatist that you described, she's keen to have a Labour government. But perhaps was your slight political departure from her happening around that time?
Not at that time. I mean, I think, no, I mean, we were, you know, she, as a lot of people at the time, I mean, let's go back. You remember there was obviously, when John died, there was obviously the moment, do you go with Blair, do you go with Brown? And she was very clear. She very much likes Gordon, respects Gordon, probably closer to Gordon politically than she was to Tony, but realised that Tony was what Labour needed at that time. And so, you know, in terms of me and her, we were on the same page. I think it's fair to say over the last few years, as I've started, you know, writing for the Mail and had my own sort of particular centrist take, I think it's fair to say that there have been a few moments where our political perspectives have diverged. I think, what was it the other day? She said to me, you're a bloody idiot, aren't you? And I tweeted it. So to this day, I get people tweeting, your mum hates you, your mum hates you. I try and explain it's political rather than personal. But there has been a parting of the ways, shall we say, on certain areas.
And around that time then, I mean, you're working in Parliament, 92 to 97, Labour are coming in, there's then a whole load of new, as in new Labour, but also fresh Labour MPs. At that point, did you think, oh my God, I'd actually like to work in Parliament long term, or even stand for Parliament myself?
I would love to. I mean, I'd love to have sort of stayed on long term, done sort of some sort of advisor role. But the way it worked out, sadly, the nepotism only reached so far. So I couldn't ever quite manage to swing that one. Although I'd loved it. Absolutely no desire at all to be an MP. I think, you know, and I've got a lot of respect for them all. And, you know, 99.9% of them are good people who are primarily there to do the best for the country. But God almighty, it's a thankless job at the best of times. If you said to me, Dan, you can become an MP on Thursday and then on Friday you can be Foreign Secretary, or, you know, you can be Defence Secretary or something like that, that might be quite fun. All right. But that's not how it works. And people don't see forget the abuse for a second, just the day to day, how hard, the long hours, how just difficult it is. if you want to be a good MP, if you want to be a bad MP, you can busk it. But if you want to be a good MP, it really is hard work. And frankly, that's not for me. Hard work like that is not for me, I'm afraid. So I'll leave that those who are much more publicly sort of publicly minded, public service minded than I am.
Do you think you sort of understood that quicker than most because your mum was one and you saw the effect on her?
Yeah, I mean, she was obviously, you know, she was obviously very robust, and she had, if you like, she brought the armour into Parliament that she'd had from being a high profile public figure before she was elected. And that was, that was useful for her. But yeah, I mean, you see close hand what the day to day grind of politics is, and it's hard. It's all encompassing. You know, I remember at the time people were saying, is she going to go carry on acting while she's being an MP? And she always said she can't. You know, you can't be a part time MP, and you certainly can't be a part time actress. So if you want to do it well, so there was that, and also, you know, a lot of PMP is mind-numbingly boring. Yeah. You know, a lot of it is, you know, a lot of it is like just sitting on the back benches for hours on end, waiting to speak. You're like a sort of the political equivalent of being a cop on a stakeout. You know, a lot of it is just like nothing going on and endless cups of coffee waiting for something to happen. You know, so.
But then you're obsessed with politics, so then you think, are you making a conscious decision? Do you think, I love this arena and I'm so sort of enamored and stimulated by it, but I don't want to go into it myself, so I'll write about it instead?
Well, I think two things. Firstly, what I would say is I'm fascinated by politics. I wouldn't necessarily say I'm obsessed by it. I mean, I think to be obsessed by it, you really have to, you know, you have to be prepared to, you know, go to the meetings, deliver the leaflets, all that sort of stuff. And I wasn't for me. As I said, I was always fascinated by the mechanics of politics and what happens behind the scenes and what happens when you pull back the curtain. In terms of the writing, I mean, I just enjoy writing. I mean, a lot of people obviously get into writing, you know, because they want to do good or change the world or, you know, have some great positive influence. None of that for me. I just actually like writing. I just like the process of writing. And I literally stumbled into it by accident. I remember one day, I think you remember Sean Simon, the former Labour MP, former MEP, who I knew quite well. And he set up this blog. It was quite new at the time to have this website, this blog, Labour Uncut. And somebody, who was it? John Crudders had been supposed to be writing an article for him. And John being John, he'd obviously not done it again, about the 15th time. So he had a gap, and Sean said, look, I've got a gap. Can you just write something, write anything, just to fill this gap? So I wrote it, and he said, brilliant, all right, I like that, we'll have more of it. And it just kind of spiraled from there. So that was kind of a sort of an accidental thing, really.
That's amazing. I had no idea that's how effectively your a phenomenal career in journalism had started.
Well, thank you. I think some of the people would probably describe it differently, but it was literally, I was having a meeting with somebody in Portcullis House one day, and Sean was there, and we had a cup of coffee, and that was it. So, you know.
Because Sean Simon and Tom Watson, the thing I remember most about Sean was Simon's early online forays was the video he did pretending to be David Cameron that got him into a lot of trouble.
But do you remember? I mean, but, you know, people get like Tom and Sean, they were the new wave. They were the cutting edge. They were the zeitgeist. They were the, you know, blogging. I remember, you know, it's that video. I'm sitting there. My mate, remember what he was saying? You know, my mate Tommy Watson, he's a proper blogger. Not like you, Cameron, you fake blogger. You, that was, and they were. It's sort of moved on a bit since then.
It hasn't. That sort of grassroots stuff. I mean, I really enjoyed, there was Labour Uncut, there was Labour Home, there was Conservative Home still going, but there was just, I guess Guido was part of that as well. And there was Recess Mongers, sort of all these just blogs started, and you just could get more colour there and more detail. And I guess there was slightly more gossip, but there was also just, it was just like a deeper well of stuff about the cultures of those political movements. I mean, I don't know whether at the time it occurred to you you were part of something very exciting and fresh, or whether you were just enjoying writing for yourself.
Well, I was enjoying writing for myself. I mean, I remember, you know, I remember the absolute terror the first time you ever, because obviously I'd done a lot of writing, I'd written articles, but they'd always gone out in my mum's name or someone else I was working for, done speeches. But, I mean, you will have experienced this, you know, the first time you actually write an article in your own name and press send, it's the most terrifying, experience you can go through. But no, I mean, certainly, I mean, when I was with Labour and Cut, I think Labour and Cut's still going, still doing some very good stuff, I think. But then I got started with the Telegraph blogs, and that was the Telegraph blogs was, I think that was the first time sort of one of the mainstream outlets had actually got sort of bought into the blogging phenomenon. And that was really fun. I mean, that was because we were, you know, we had a completely diverse group of people. There was me, there was Oborne, there was God knows who was there. And, you know, and that was fun because we were, again, we were sort of leading the way with that. And there was all, you know, and the thing was, you could turn stuff around very quickly. You know, that was the real thing. You were doing, you know, you were writing stuff in real time, which it obviously hadn't happened before. So that was good. Obviously led to some of my more unfortunate, erroneous political takes, you know, writing at speed. That's my excuse. But that was a good, very good fun time.
And are there any particular erroneous political takes that stay with you?
Oh, God, so many. David Miliband has won, I think, was the one that kicked it off. Although that wasn't my fault. I put at the bottom, I built a trapdoor at the bottom of the article, and it was like, David Miliband has won, hasn't he? ? And of course, Sean Simon pulled out. They said, no, you either say it or you don't. So I said, all right, let's say it. And of course, that was it. And you know, ever since then, I've been famed for my very accurate powers of political persuasion.
If you put enough stuff out there, I mean, it's like going down the bookies, isn't it? You're going to get it wrong more than you're going to get it right because of the sheer volume of prediction.
Yeah, I mean, that's the point. I mean, the thing for me was, I mean, you know, and obviously I still regard myself as sort of someone who's relatively new to this, but the thing that always slightly frustrated me when I was reading political commentary myself was you would read some of the great political commentators, and you would read this wonderful 1,000-word thesis, and for 900 words of it, it would be about, you know, this is why I think this thing is going to happen politically, and then the last 100 words were, yeah, but it might not, and this is why it might not happen. And I always thought, oh, come on, guys, you know, if you're going to do it. So yes. Yeah, you sometimes get it right, sometimes you get it wrong.
But obviously you started off in Labour circles, you know, working for a Labour MP, writing for Labour on Cut. Many of us over the last 10, 15 years have had a very changing relationship with the Labour Party, to put it mildly. How do you feel about Labour now?
Well, I mean, compared to obviously what preceded it, I mean, it's just, you know, it's just chalk and cheese. I actually think, I think there are a couple of stages. I think, it's like I said, I don't think, hand on heart, I don't think you can honestly say there is the same energy, dynamism, nor the same sort of structure and sort of direction and proper guidance to the Starmer project to the same way there was under New Labour. That said, I mean, I do think he personally over the last 6 months has become, I mean, I wrote about this a few weeks ago, he personally has clearly become much, much bolder in terms of, you know, picking up the party and moving it further to the centre, which is what I think he needs to do. Obviously, other people will, you know, fiercely disagree, but that's clearly what he's doing. And I think it's quite clear, just looking at him, speaking to people around him, he has decided the Tories are there for the taking now, and he wants to take them out completely. And he's not just going to sit in and just hope that they lose the election. And I think that is that's the right strategy. I think the question is now, you know, we're all still looking at Labour to an extent through the prism: is this the leader? Is this the party? Is this the shadow cabinet that can win the next election? My own view, you know, a lot of things can still happen. But I just at the moment can't see how the Tories just get themselves out of the hole they're in. And I think, you know, over the next few weeks and months, Starmer start thinking about and presenting, and Labour are going to have to start thinking about how they govern. And if and at the moment, I think there are still a lot of gaps that need to be filled in there. I mean, it was interesting. I was chatting to one of the Tory spads, Tory, I can't remember if it was a spad or minister, who said to me before Christmas that one of the things they're clinging to is they look back at the Labour sort of the shadow front bench under Blair. And obviously, you've got Blair, you've got Brown, you've got Dewar, you've got Cook, you've got Prescott, but people who are big heavyweights. Now, it could be, I don't know whether it's a product of, you know, people like me and you, we always look back at, you know, this golden age where we were there, and, you know, and it's just, you know, obviously a lot of very able people, a lot of talented people on the front bench. Does the Labour, does the shallow front bench currently have the heft, the stature, the status, the weight of that shadow cabinet? I can't honestly say I think it does at the moment, but obviously we haven't actually seen them really setting out their perspectives for government. So as that progresses, maybe that'll happen. But the key thing is, obviously, compared to the madness of, you know, a couple of years ago, it's not even comparable.
No, and I guess, does Liz Truss compare to Margaret Thatcher? Does Rishi Sunak compare to
Winston Churchill? I think we could definitively answer that one. And I don't think the jury's out there.
What Labour does have, I mean, we're both football fans. What Labour does have, it almost feels like, I mean, Starmer often gets compared to Southgate, and I can see why. But you'd also say that it has a kind of, you know, if you're looking for Fodens and Bellinghams, then people, as well as, you know, Rachel Reeves, but coming talents like Bridget Phillipson and Wes Streeting and Peter Kyle, it feels as if, though, not just this generation, but maybe the exciting thing for Labour is in 5 years' time, these people will have really developed into really quite special political talents.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there certainly is talent there. I mean, I was actually literally having this conversation with somebody the other day about, again, using the football analogy. I mean, I think the one concern I would have, just again, and we've obviously got the reshuffle coming up, so it'll be interesting to see what he does. It was the shadow cabinet reshuffle. I just wonder if the best talent is currently in the best place in the Labour Party. So you look at somebody like Wes, for example, who I think, you know, everybody across the political spectrum is impressed by. He's sitting in health at the moment. As you know, the safest, most comfortable brief for a Labour politician is the health brief. He's going to come in. I mean, he's obviously talking very impressively about reform, radical reform, blah, 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 taking on the BMA, etc. We all know that when Labour comes into government, that is just going to get pushed aside. Labour is going to, you know, Rachel Reeves is going to have to get shed loads of money. She's going to have to chuck it at health service. They're going to have to spend their way out of the current crisis. You know, taking on the BMA, taking on the nursing unions, that's for the birds. That's not going to happen. If Wes tries it, Keir will call him and say, you know, Wes, let's just keep things quiet on health. We don't want a row about health. So the analogy I was saying, you know, with people like him, similarly Bridget Phillipson, education, again, you know, currently working on some quite radical education reform plans. Is Keir Starmer going to want his first 5 years to be defined by a fight with the teachers? No, he's not. So that he's got people there with quite significant radical reforming energy. Are they sitting in the best briefs? And I think at the moment there's a bit of, to use the football analogy, it's a bit like playing Haaland in central midfield. You know, is he deploying his best people in the best positions? That I think that's one of the things I think it's going to be interesting to see going forward.
And how do you feel about the party as a thing? I mean, were you ever one of those people that got romantic about it? I'm guessing perhaps not. But did you ever feel like, oh, the Labour Party is this great thing and it's, you know, the best way to change the country? Or have you always had a kind of pragmatic view of political parties?
No, I mean, I always had the view that the people's sort of love. If I ever met anybody who says I love the Labour Party, right? Frankly, you know, I'd smile and humour them. But when you're saying you love a political party, I mean, that's a little bit odd. I mean, you know, no disrespect to, you know, and obviously people give, you know, a lot of committed people have put a lot of work in for the Labour Party and for almost exclusively the right reasons, but it is a bit odd. And, you know, we, I mean, obviously we were talking about the, we touched on the madness of the last few years. I mean, we rightly we touched on the cult of Corbyn, right? But you and I saw firsthand the cult of Blair, and the cult of, you know, and the Blair cult has had their moments as well. You know, there was a moment you said anything bad about Tony, and it was like right off to the, you know, off to the ducking stool for them. And what I found was, I mean, I think it's broader than, you know, people's sort of, once you find yourself loving a political party and looking for, you know, the leader of the political party to be these heroic, these heroic figures, you're getting yourself into a pretty difficult place. Because, I mean, I saw it with Blair. I mean, you know, obviously I was a bought and paid up member of, you know, Carcarran member of New Labour. Saw Blair and the Blair government lose the way, saw it end in what frankly is, you know, I still believe is, you know, the horror show that was Iraq, which was just, you know, without being political, it was just an absolute horror show. And that's where I suddenly realized, if you're investing so much in political projects and the leaders of those political projects, you are ultimately going to be disillusioned. And if you are disillusioned, ultimately that's going to be your fault, not theirs. And it's, again, to use the football analogy, there were always elements of Labour, like we were like Newcastle, you know, we had a Messiah complex. We were looking for our Keegan, we were looking for, someone to come down from the mountain and lead us to the promised land. And it kind of happened, but it didn't, you know, it ended in tears. And it's, and the point is, it's always going to end in tears. So, and I think you just have to realise that.
And then how do you feel about the party post-Corbyn then? Because, my fear for the Labour, just in terms of a political observer, really, as an outsider during the Corbyn era, was that the damage to the Labour Party was so profound and so deep that it might never recover. And I think it's a real tribute to Keir Starmer's personality, to his character, to political skill that, I mean, obviously, the Tories have imploded, but they'd imploded multiple times during the Corbyn years. But to take them from 2019 to the point where we are talking about Labour as the next government now, whether that happens or not, there's a long way to go and all the rest of it. But the fact that he's managed to do that is testament to him. But what about the party underneath him? I mean, do you think that the public still have a wariness of Labour after everything that went on?
Yeah, I think the public do have a wariness of Labour, and I think the public are right to have a wariness of Labour. I mean, you know, as I've said, credit where credit's due to where Keir Starmer has taken Labour politically. And obviously, you know, there are efforts being made now to drive out the last sort of rancid vestiges of the Corbynite rump, and that's been done quite effectively. But I do think in the sort of the excitement of where Labour is positioned now politically, I do think people are going to, certainly when Labour gets into government, are going to need to step back a bit and just be a little bit, have a little bit of more introspection than it's taking place at the moment about where Labour found itself. Because, you know, I mean, I was obviously heavily criticised for the time. The stain of anti-Semitism and everything that was around that, and the sort of the hard left, the vicious hard left political radicalism that underpinned it, that wasn't just an unfortunate aberration for the Labour Party. That was a moment of absolute shame. And you know, I speak, you know, occasionally I'll bump into some of the the group of Labour MPs who, you know, obviously resigned, you know, made the ultimate move, resigned their seats, said we're not to plan this, and stood again and basically gave up their political careers. And a lot of them are quite bitter, not just about whether they're bitter towards Starmer, because their thing is, well, where was Keir when we were making the stand? He was sitting in the shadow cabinet alongside Jeremy Corbyn, you know, looking the other way. And that criticism is fair. That is fair. Now, you know, Keir Starmer's done a lot. He's obviously very committed to getting the elements of anti-Semitism and all those elements out of the party, but he was missing in action at the time, and basically the entire Labour movement, frankly, was, apart from some very honourable exceptions, was missing in action. So that is something that is going to need to be addressed, not just on a political level, not just so that people understand, you know, Labour's can be trusted and electable, but just in terms of just showing that when Labour, you know, talks about, you know, you know, being inclusive and fighting racism and, you know, and diversity and multicultural and all that sort of stuff, it's actually prepared to put its money where its mouth is.
Obviously, over the last few years, with the sort of your take on Labour politics as it is in the social media age, has led to you, you know, getting slews of abuse online. Does that get to you, or are you pretty robust about that sort of thing?
No, I mean, I think, you know, any of us who are in the public, you know, we've all got to say, oh, no, it doesn't bother me. I mean, you know, none of us like being told we're, you know, I won't say it on air, but you get it as well. So you know what it's like. And none of us look at that and think, oh, brilliant. But I mean, I think we are overly obsessed with social media. I mean, we're sort of eating ourselves alive on this, but we're talking about it, so let's go with it. I think it, certainly in terms of what I do, I think it is good. I mean, it is good for me as a writer that I now engage. It's good for me to engage with people on what I write. I you know, just if you're listening to this, I'd really love if you could engage with what I write, not just the headline. But that's just, you know. But anyway, that's my plea. But I think that's good, and I think it makes all of us who do this better. And I think it's good that we, you know, we're not in a position where we just hand down our views, you know, from the mountaintop, and then nobody can engage with it. I think that's the positive. Obviously, it's good for getting the getting round to quite your articles and views around to a diverse audience. I do think, though, and I you know, I've seen this again. I sort of think I'm relatively new, but there are a lot of people who I see, you know, meet who are getting into writing, who are much newer to it than me, and I do think they find it hard. I think young journalists, even some very experienced journalists, do find the constant abuse, not just the abuse. You know, the biggest, you know, one of the biggest crimes in society at the moment is getting ratioed. And what does getting ratioed mean? It means just you've said something that a lot of people don't agree with. Well, that's part of what commentary and writing and debate is about. If all we're doing is saying things that each of us agrees with, then there's no point in it. And I think I have noticed that a lot of very good writers, and again, some of them are quite experienced, you can just see it. They're starting to write for Twitter. They're starting to write for social media. You can see areas where they've pulled their punches or they've included a line. I've done it myself. You know, times I've written something, I've suddenly thought, I don't actually believe that. I'm just writing that because I think that'll stop Twitter being nasty to me, or I think that's what Twitter wants here. And then I've, you know, taken it out. And that's I think that is the danger, the way that we within the media are, as a result of social media, are increasingly under pressure to self-centre. Because the biggest difficulty for a variety of factors is when you become a commentator is what you think, and actually getting what you think out onto the page, because you have to censor yourself. There are certain conventions in terms of language, you know, people think you can use, you can't use anymore. And that's the minefield you have to negotiate. And social media does throw quite a lot of obstacles in the way. But it's the job. You know, if you really are worried about people reacting in a negative way to something you say on social media, then maybe the media commentary isn't really the gig for you, and maybe you should be, I don't know, maybe you should be thinking something else, without in any way excusing any of the abuse that people get or whatever. You know, I that's kind of where I come from.
When I know how I feel when I get ratioed, which for people who aren't very online, that's basically when a particular tweet gets lots of replies. Basically, you think, oh god, this is effectively there are more replies than there are retweets.
You worry about it too much. You see, that's the thing, you take it too seriously. See, I just chuck this stuff out there. Some of it, you know, I get ratioed twice a day, three times a day. It's fine.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Is ever, I mean, you're pretty fearless. I think I am as well. It's just that, it's just occasionally, it's that sinking feeling of going, oh God, you know, am I going to be today's punch bag on Twitter? And that's never a pleasant feeling. But it is ever part of the dread that actually your employer might not stand behind you? I mean, people might presume actually the Mail on Sunday would be quite a robust defender of it.
That's the thing. I mean, people can criticise, you know, the Mail, whatever, but the newspaper, my editors, I mean, that is one of the best things about, you know, I have a degree of, you know, I have, you know, I can be in you know, with obviously certain, you know, parameters. I can't be excessively abusive or whatever, but I've got license to pretty much say what I like. And, you know, they will stand by me. And I do think, I mean, this is the other thing. I mean, you know, again, you can't have a rational debate about this, but we do live now in an era where on both left and right, there is a desire to basically shut down views that people don't agree with, rather than engage. And in a lot of instances, I mean, again, we know this historically, you know, it comes from the best of motives. You know, I grew up in an era where there were, you know, things were on TV that would be anathema to us now, and things that were just supposed to be a joke or whatever, or it's just a laugh it off, obviously would be completely socially unacceptable now. But equally, I do think in a desire to, the desire to have a more inclusive society and a more inclusive debate, we are now becoming increasingly intolerant. There is a liberal and not just conservative purience now, but a liberal purience that you can see creeping in into debate. There is a desire to censor, to kill off legitimate discussion. Look, I don't think any of us would agree with what Clarkson wrote the other day, but when you see MPs standing up saying, you know, we need to change the law so people can presumably be imprisoned for writing what he wrote, then we're on a slippery slope. And I think everybody, obviously nobody will, you know, it's not a plea that's going to be honoured, but we all have to step back. And, I think it's a difficult decision, because we are actually going to have to take a decision, which is, do we want to live in a society where we hear reprehensible views, but balance that by the fact that we live in a society in which we can have free and open and honest debate, even though we may not like what elements of that debate are? Or do we want to curtail and censor and suppress certain views because we think they have a malign influence on society? But understand that if we do that, then ultimately, as part of that, we are going to end up censoring legitimate views as well. And, you know, you hear this stuff, and again, this stuff about censoring stuff that is legal but harmful. I mean, again, you're getting into very, very dodgy political and sort of principle debates, because you'll get this as well. You know, we used to think, back in the day, we used to think this was easy, right? Because it was easy. Like, you had a guy with a swastika walking up the high street, you think, right, well, he's, you know, NF guy. Well, you shouldn't be here, mate, right? So, you know, we don't want you in. As you well know, because the debate's become so polarized on both sides, you know, you and I now are, you know, every week or so, I'm told I'm like some evil hate-mongering racist who needs to be stamped out. So, where do we? I mean, we're good guys, aren't we? Aren't we?
Oh God, tell us,
we're the good guys, aren't we? Are we the baddies now? You know what? But you know what I mean? You know, I don't think anybody objectively would say you and I are particularly hate-filled human beings. But you know, obviously others may disagree, but you know, I think that is a problem, and where we land on that is going to be one of the biggest issues, I think, for the next decade or so.
And just thinking about some of the other pressures on political commentators and on you personally, if one is that you occasionally think, oh, am I writing for social media? Is the other pressure effectively the desire for clickbait? And I don't think, maybe this doesn't affect you as much, but looking at the sort of things that where people are just constantly trying to go viral all the time, that actually there's a sort of cheapening of the quality of journalism on social media.
Yeah, to an extent. I mean, I think, look, I mean, I get it. You know, I get, I mean, I, again, get told, oh, this is just clickbait. And I have to say, no, actually, you know what is worse than that? I do actually believe this stuff. But yeah, I mean, there's obvious pressure for that. I think we can all see it, though. You know, I think I'm not embarrassing anybody by name, but we can, we all know who plays that game. And again, it comes back to the point I was making. If you get yourself in the position where you're saying, I am writing this because I think it will get X or Y reaction, as opposed to I'm writing this because it's what I actually think, then you're already lost in the weeds, and you're already losing your way. I mean, the other thing I would say is to all the people who, you know, decry clickbait, don't click. we have this thing about, oh God, it's terrible, it's clickbait, and all these, you know, and they're just another troll and whatever. Well, they only do it because you respond to it. And the reality is, you know, what anyone says, the reality is everybody runs around saying, oh, we want evidence-based debate, and we want, you know, we want proper argument, we want facts and all that sort of stuff. No, you don't. Most of you don't want that. What you want is your own worldview reinforced. And that's on both sides of the debate. And, you know, we live in a much more tribal era, and the loudest people are the ones who simply got no interest in any sort of actual discussion or analysis. They just want their viewpoint upheld, and they want their side to win, which is fine, and I understand it. And I used to be, you know, back in my day when I was working for Labour, that's how I was. But that's not what you do when you're a commentator. And I do still think, despite that, there is a block of people, a significant block of people in the middle, who do want to, obviously everyone's got their own views, who do want to engage, who do want to listen to different arguments and engage in a relatively constructive and respectful way.
And how much freedom do you have at the Mail on Sunday to just write whatever you like?
I have complete freedom. I mean, like I said, I can't be excessively abusive and, you know, etc. You know, if I wanted to sort of have a platform to extol the virtues of Jeremy Corbyn and the Corbynite project, I'd probably have to look to a different platform than the Mail. But I don't think that anyway. And there's never, you know, say hand on heart. I know it's there, isn't it? That's where it's the side. Say hand on heart. You know, nobody believes it, but again, it's true. There's never been a time when anyone's tried to influence what I write. And, you know, again, I'm really sorry, but I do genuinely believe this stuff.
Without sounding wanky, like, do you have a process? Do you have a kind of a structure during the week where you think, I'm going to decide on a thing, I'm going to narrow it down to three things, write about that, and then within the article I have a particular... You know, what is a kind of Dan Hodges masterclass for writing a political
article? Yeah, I mean, I do have a process, but as with every process, it always falls apart very rapidly, and then I just have to, like, scrabble around. I mean, the point about, obviously, there's the discipline of writing for a Sunday newspaper, so you have to try and, to an extent, come up with a perspective that's slightly new. The practicalities of it are that you have to sort of establish ideas, you know, with your editorial team relatively early in the week. But by the end of the week, obviously, the political agenda might have changed. I mean, what I try to do is I always try to get about two or three ideas about something that I want to write about. I usually have one thing that I'm keener on. I'll say to my editors, look, This is where I'm thinking of going. Is there anything you think I should be covering? And then it generally arises out of that.
And if you like pitch an idea, do they ever say, oh, sorry, someone else is already writing that? You're going to have to write about it.
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, we always got a lot of people. There's times say, well, I think someone else is covering it, or it may be better if somebody else covers that. Sometimes I may think, I don't think that's an idea for this week. You know, maybe they think there's something more current, or it's something that might sit better in a couple of weeks. And that's part of it. You know, you want to try and, you know, you don't want to be the journalistic equivalent of Rishi Sunak, you know, banging on about, you know, maths when the nation's up in arms about, you know, wants to hear what you're going to do on strikes and, you know, strikes and God knows, you know, cost of living, you know, et cetera. So you've got to try, you want to try and be relevant and current whilst obviously attempting to sort of move the agenda forward or bring in a different perspective. So that's part of the trick. And that's why you've got, you know, obviously we all sit there and, you know, we're all very, you know, you pitch an idea and you think this is a brilliant idea, but you know, we have editors for a reason, and they're, you know, they always prove to be right on this sort of stuff. So yeah, that's how we sort of manage it.
Something people may not know about you is that you lost the sight in one eye, intervening in a fight in a pub in 1992, obviously 31 years ago.
Yeah, quite close to the election.
What happened?
I was in a pub with some mates. There was an altercation between me, an altercation between a friend of mine and someone across the bar. At the time, we thought there might have been a racial element to it. I don't actually think there was. I got up to sort of try and put myself in between the two people, tried to act as peacemaker, did an absolutely appalling job, turned away and just got hit. And that was it. I mean, it wasn't any more sort of dramatic or heroic than that, to be honest.
But it was a horrific thing to go. I mean, you must have been pretty young at the time.
Yeah, I was. I mean, the point is, obviously nobody wants anything like that to happen to you. And it's obviously, you know, a terrible experience when you go through it. But to be honest, we're quite robust when we're young. You know, we bounce physically, we bounce emotionally, and I had a good group of friends around me. I had, you know, strong family group around me. You know, I'm going to be completely honest with you. I mean, as you said, it happened in 92. The election was coming up. I was so focused on the election. I thought, oh, fuck, I hope I'm not going to miss the election because of this. It was bad, but you get two for a reason. You know, you get two of these things for a reason. So yeah,
you just don't ever intervene ever again, or no. Only intervene.
No, I don't. I just in any sort of actual conflict situation, you'll find me running the opposite direction. You know, that's what I took from that.
The temptation would be to try and extrapolate some political legacy from it, to say actually that gave you a that stopped you being a kind of namby-pamby liberal about crime and really gave you a direct experience of how cruel the world can be, and that effectively burnished a kind of pragmatic centrism. But would that be overreaching? Yeah.
That would be massively overreaching. Yeah, sorry. None of that. I'm sorry. I'm just not that deep. I'm not that. I wish I was. You know, maybe I'm going to go away. Maybe I'll go away and have a think later on, and maybe, you know, I'll sort of psychoanalyze that. Or actually, maybe how many people listen to your podcast? Maybe I'll just pretend. Maybe I'll just adopt that now and just pretend.
Millions of people listen. Millions every day.
Oh, well, then that's torn that.
But I always thought, you know, having an experience of, because I grew up in a rough area, and that definitely affected my view of crime. So when I would go to Labour Party meetings in more middle-class parts of the country, and they would worry about perhaps more that, you know, as I did, why people commit crime, but less emphasis on victims, perhaps. I would say to them, have you ever been burgled? Have you ever been mugged? Have you ever had a knife pulled on you in the street? And those people often hadn't, whereas I had. I say, when you've actually been in this situation, makes you desperate for the police. Now, whatever the problems with the police, and I totally understand that as a white man, however disadvantaged I was economically growing up, I never had to deal with the police racially abusing me. But nevertheless, it definitely, in sort of later life, I've perhaps reflected on, I say that, I'm 40, but, you know, it definitely made me think, actually, that those experiences in youth of experiencing crime in a very direct way definitely, in effect, made me more New Labour than perhaps I might have otherwise been.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something in that. I mean, for me, it wasn't so much. I mean, I couldn't really sort of pin any sort of great sort of political epiphany to that particular incident. I mean, I think for me, more broad, where I think you're right, though, and I think you've probably got sort of, I mean, you're simple, where we sort of probably align on this, is obviously, I came from a wonderfully, as I mean, I mean this, I'm not trying to be sort of cute here, but I mean, obviously, I'm not daft, I had a very privileged, middle class upbringing, but within that, I mean, as I said, I had an extended family who, very much retained my mum's sort of northern, sort of northwest sort of working class perspective. My dad's similarly. And also I did actually go, really boasts about this, try to boast about this, but it's true. I actually went to the sort of local comprehensive. It's, people now fight over trying to say how terrible their school was because it gives them credit. But I mean, I genuinely did. And, my friend, I wasn't hanging around with, like the sons of Oscar-winning actresses. I was,
You were the son of an Oscar-winning actress.
I was.
Other people were hanging around with you.
Yeah, exactly. So that, my friend, which is from South London, and so I think because of that, you had a sort of slightly more working class perspective. And I think, we were talking about Labour and past and present. I do think the one thing that is going to need to be addressed is, I think New Labour, successful though it was, and it was actually kind of a product of its success, a big part of the whole New Labour project was moving away from our traditional base to more, middle class, reaching out to more middle class voters, parts of the country that hadn't voted Labour traditionally. And I think as a result of that, and you can see it now with Keir, God bless him, Labour is very much a middle class product now. I mean, it's a middle class party. There are good elements of that. I don't buy into this. Everyone who's middle class is, just some woke liberal who should be dismissed. But I do think there are areas of policy and Labour, areas of Labour's debate where middle class, working class voices are, if not looked down on, are slightly excluded. And there's an attempt to reinterpret a working class worldview in a way that aligns with a policy agenda that and an outlook that middle class people want, and it doesn't all, as you know, it doesn't always work like that. There are a lot of policy areas where, rightly or wrongly, the middle class elements of Labour become detached from huge swathes of working class Britain, and a realignment needs to take place there, and it can't just be economic. That has to be a part of it. It's got to be a significant part of it. There has to be a sort of a cultural realignment as well. And I think whilst Labour is much more comfortable in looking at the economics realignment there, when it comes to cultural elements and elements, like you said, law and order, then suddenly Labour goes, "Ooh, I'm not. Too, yeah, we want to represent working class, but." Not like that. In other bits, and I think that's something that the party's going to have to look at.
You wrote a brilliant book about the 2015 election called 1 Minute to
Ten. Oh, you read it? Thank you.
You're the one that bought it.
You're the one that bought it. Excellent. I went into a bookshop a couple of weeks ago, and my wife said to me, "Oh, look, you're." It's not good. They've got your book. I said, "What do you mean it's good? I wrote it about 7 years ago. I still haven't sold it." Thank you.
Well, I think it's a good sign, because then it means someone must have bought it, and then they only buy book. They only have books on display that they sell. So that means people have continued.
Thank you. Thank you for sugarcoating it. It's not the fact that book's been sitting on the shelf in Bluewater Waterstones for 7 years is not a good sign. It's not a good sign.
But it is a great book, and people should buy it. And there is a link in the blurb so that people can buy it. And it captures the drama of those individuals awaiting their fate, and the great sort of... effectively, your book helped inform people's understanding of that night, which was David Cameron's writing his resignation speech, Ed Miliband's writing his acceptance speech, and then the exit poll comes out, and the whole thing's very different. So when you're writing a book like that in that style... Obviously, there's a certain element of dramatic license, but in a way, you made it difficult for yourself because you needed sources from all parties. And were they easy to come by?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the. I mean, look, when you have a national platform, a national newspaper column, then people, you know, it will open doors to you. People will speak to you. They may not want to speak to you, but they've got to. So there's part, you know, that's a part of it. I mean, I think one of the things, you know, I suppose it partly comes down to my a number of things, because I saw it through my mum and I saw it working at Parliament. This idea that people in different political parties are all evil people who, you know, the Tories, all they just hate the poor and they want to kill poor people and sell off the NHS. I completely understand why people like to peddle that, but it's just not true. So that's fun. And I've met a lot of Tories, a lot of, you know, people from the SNP, DUP, Whisper It, even some nice Lib Dems. I'm joking, Lib Dems, you're lovely people. So, but when I was working, I mean, one of the things I was going back to when I was working at Parliament, the good thing about that 92 to 97 period, everybody knew by the end, sort of halfway through, Labour was going to win, like Blair was going to win. So that sort of anger and sort of viciousness, the Tories had given up, the Tories weren't scared by Labour. So actually, in a social basis, you know, we'd all go in the pub, we'd all go in the Red Line on a Friday night, and there'd be Labour researchers there, Tory researchers there, and we'd all hang out together. And as a product of that, you just get to know each other. So in terms of engaging with people, you know, outside of what was traditionally my tribe, that's never been a problem for me. I mean, obviously, a lot of people think it is a problem and I'm some sort of sellout or whatever, and fair enough. But that was, you know, so no, that was something I was fortunately able to do.
And did any of the people that you write about ever get in touch and say, how did you know that? Or it didn't happen like that? Or you bastard?
No, because none of them read it. None of them read it. So in terms of the book, I mean, I frequently, obviously, in terms of the column, get people ringing up early and all sorts of abuse at me for things I do and don't know and write and don't write and that they say I've got wrong. But, and again, you know, that's part of where, you know, we were talking about a social media thing. That's part of where that actually comes in quite handy. You constantly getting people from all sides trying to pressure you into writing things, the things that they want you to write, rather than the things that you actually think. And that is what, you know, 90% of the job is having to resist that, you know, rightly or wrongly. I mean, obviously you want to get, you know, you want to have good sources. You want everything to be good sourced. We all make mistakes. You know, we all get told things by sources that turn out subsequently to be wrong. But, you know, that's the nature of the business. But, you know, that's, as I said, you know, understanding that people, if you want to be a writer, you've got to understand a lot of people aren't going to like what you write.
And has it given you a desire to write another book? I mean, just thinking, it might not even be about the election. Obviously, the next election might be close. It might have a surprising outcome. There's a whole number of things that may or may not happen, given the way that politics and the polling is going. Do you think I'd like to write another one like that, or maybe fiction?
I would. I would like to write another political book. I'd like to do a work of fiction as well. In fact, I'm actually currently working on a work of fiction at the moment, but I'm not going to say anything about it at the moment because I'm only halfway through it, and it's so complete. The premise is so completely insane. You wouldn't believe it if I told you so, because it's so nothing to do with politics. I'll come back on and I'll tell you. I'll let you help promote it when it maybe we'll get someone to read that one. But no, I would like a couple of problems. It's such a crowded field. You've obviously got, like, you know, you had Harry Cole and James Hill's books come out and has gone down a storm. Tim Shipman's books, you know, every one of them is a must read, and they cover so much space. The thing, if I was going to write another book, you know, I think you have to bring in, you have to bring a degree of insight into something and show people something that they weren't aware of before. And you also have to, I think, you have to bring in a degree of drama. That's what I try to do with my book. And the problem is, the last few years, politics has been so insane and so nuts and so beyond the realms of what any form of dramatic fiction could could possibly be. But it's like, what can you, what value can you add at that? Can anyone add at the moment? You know, I mean, I tried to take what was a relatively sort of relatively boring bog standard election with some relatively boring bog standard political characters like, you know, Ed and David Cameron and Nick Clegg, and tried to bring it to life. Well, I mean, but how can any, how, if you're going to drama, you know, I understand there are people looking at dramatizing elements of what's been happening over the last few years. How can anybody dramatize this? What we've all just lived through.
And what if, and it might not be a Labour politician, it might be a Tory or a Lib Dem or a politician that you liked and agreed with, said, I want you to be my press spokesman or my head of media. Would that sort of thing ever appeal?
At the moment, I would say no, because I'm just loving what I'm doing, and it's such a fascinating time to be writing about politics. Obviously, James Forsyth has just kind of nicked that gig, hasn't he? I mean, he's just kind of done that. So I might see how James pans out for James first, and then see. I can't see it at the moment, but you know, never say never. You know, Keir picks up the phone. You know. Rishi picks up the phone after his dramatic win. You know, Boris, who knows? I can't see it happening, but, you know, never say never. Never say never.
I mean, obviously, we've touched on earlier, you know, how so many political predictions turn out to be false. Do you think Boris will ever come back?
I don't. I think there's, you know, the next 6 months... He's going to, unless he literally comes up and does a speech and completely rules it out. But then even if he does that, no one will believe him. The next 6 months is going to be dominated by, you know, Boris, will he, won't he? I mean, that's a whole thing that's going to, again, just completely pull the rug out from poor Rishi. I don't think he will, because the thing that all prime ministers, and particularly former prime ministers, obsess about more than anything else is their legacy. And whether you like it or not, and I think a lot of people won't like it, Boris's legacy is assured now. He's locked in, right, at the moment. He will always be able to say, won us the election when people said I couldn't, saw off Corbyn, got us through COVID, took the lead on Ukraine, I was gonna start getting the grips with all the other stuff, and they threw me out. Look what happened to the Conservative Party after I was ditched. We were 5 points behind, then we went to 30 points behind. Everything fell apart. For him to come back, it would have to be in circumstances where the Tories are so desperate they think we've got nothing to lose. And in those circumstances, why would Boris want to come back? I mean, he will not come back if he thinks he's going to lose a general election to Keir Starmer, because in those circumstances, at that point, his legacy, Boris the magician, gets destroyed. So there'll be the local elections. They'll do terribly in the local elections. There'll be a big Boris come back. I think we'll have a little bit of what we had, you know, with the has he got 100 named sort of playing a bit of footsie. But I just can't see it. I really don't think, because I don't think he wants to do it. Also, I mean, He's earning a shed load of money out there, and I think he wants to keep earning a shed load of money.
I think he probably does. Dan, this has been such a treat. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me, mate.
Well, there you go, Dan Hodges. What a fantastic chat. And I'm a real sucker for going, oh, this thing happened, and therefore that must have had some political impact on you. And I just think... maybe sometimes it just didn't. And I think perhaps I need to stop trying to extrapolate politics from every event in people's lives and go, oh, well, that happened to you. Therefore, that must mean that gave you a right-wing view or a left-wing view or a centrist view or whatever. But what a fantastic guest. And his book is brilliant. And follow him on social media. He's a very gifted writer. And thank you for downloading this, the first one of the new year. And don't forget to come to the live shows. Emily Maitlis and John Sopel, a.k.a. two-thirds of the news agents, on the 23rd of January. Keir Starmer on the 20th of February. Eddie Izzard on the 6th of March. And loads more guests to be announced for the coming year. please leave a 5-star written review. It helps the show get up the charts, and just share it far and wide. Tell your friends and family. Tell strangers in the street about it. And I'll see you next week. Ta-ra.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.